What would you recommend to somebody who's just starting?
You have to work out what you're who you're working for. Because are you working for a label, Dolby, or the artist, or are they all mutually exclusive? Something that's really complicated.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is legendary producer-engineer Ken Scott, who, aside from being one of the five main engineers for the Beatles, also worked on some of the most notable albums by David Bowie, Elton John, Jeff Beck, Supertramp, and so many more. Ken spoke about his two most recent David Bowie projects, Divine Symmetry, made up of overlooked tracks from David's Hunky Dory era, and Rock and Roll Star from his Ziggy Stardust era. Rock and Roll Star was mixed immersively in Atmos, so we talked at length about Ken's unusual approach and his overall feeling about the format. Also featured today is Ken's engineer in the project, Emery Ramazanoglu, who has a wealth of immersive mixing experience and filled in the technical details. I spoke with Ken and Emery via Zoom from their respective homes in the UK. So, Ken, tell me about getting involved in finding these outtakes and things that were overlooked. Did you know they were there? Were you called in about this, or how did that work?
I had absolutely no idea what there was. Initially, I was asked by Warner to look into doing stuff for Hunky Dory. There wasn't much there, so I finished up doing some mixes, revisiting some of the original mixes and just doing them better or different. I can't say better, different. Upgrading them a bit, putting drum samples in along with the original drum set. Woody couldn't complain that they sound like cornflakes packets anymore. And a little bit in there that I don't think had seen the light of day before, unless it was on bootlegs. But then the biggie was Ziggy, because we had every single tape for that. And so I got to go through it all when they asked me, and found all of these various takes, the master track, but a different vocal. There were things that we started that we never completed, and I tarted them up a bit. If there was a single acoustic guitar and I thought, oh, it'd be better with double track, I'd go to another take that had a acoustic guitar, fly it in and elastic audio it so that it's in time and all of that kind of thing, and just tarten them up so that they're a little more presentable than they necessarily were, just leaving them as they were.
You have no qualms about changing things. I mean, there are a lot of purists that would say you should keep everything the way it was, but for you, it's like, well, let's just make it better.
Not totally. I have no problem doing it as long as the original is always available. Now, I know that's difficult these days with streaming. You never quite know what you're going to get. And that's one of the problem. One of the things that I insist when I do these kind of things is it has to have a different title. Whether it's Changes 2023 or something like that, it has a different title. So at least people now can tell what they're getting.
And for the most part, what's the response then when they hear something that's kind of tarted up as to what they're used to?
So far, it's been good. I haven't heard that much. From what I've heard, people love it. It works. And it's with Hunky Dory, there were only I think there were three things that I revisited. The Atmos of Ziggy that's going to be very interesting. And I have to say, the response to that, and once again, completely upgraded it, shall we say, because my basic feeling in going into it was that the glam rock sound was fine for the 1970s, but we're in the 2020s now and it needs to be modernized a bit. So once again, I went in. The first thing that I changed was the drums, because that dry drum sound is so much a part of the glam rock sound. And so I went in some used samples for snare, kick, some toms, and then eventually it finished up. I think Emre might actually smile at this bit. It actually came to doing cymbals and hi-hat as well, which slightly painstaking. Going in and moving every single hi-hat beat from the for the sample to make sure it's exactly in sync with the original. And yeah, but Emre is a drummer, so he would be the perfect person to say, you know what, that doesn't feel quite right. And he never said a word, so I guess it was good.
Right.
I
Yeah, I just couldn't tell. I really couldn't tell. I mean,
would have had to look at the multi-track to have a, even the hats, which was really, we had to check that they were in at one point. I do remember that. I think it was on Suffragette City perhaps, but we were checking, are they in? Oh, they are. Oh my God, they're definitely. We didn't even know. That was really, really impressive.
So did you spend most of your time then on the drums?
Pre-mixing, yeah. As such, yeah, because that was very time-consuming. Almost everything else was left as is and just affected within Atmos.
Well, let's talk about Atmos for a second then. So where did you do it?
Where did we do it, Emre?
So I found the mute button. We did this in Rack 4, where they've got I think it's a 9.1.4 Genelec setup, which is really good there. Really directional speakers, which is great in smaller Atmos rooms because you get quite a small sweet spot, but it's really good. The imaging's insane, so we can get decent translation everywhere, which is why I like them. And then the GLN lets us dial in a sound that is familiar, certainly to me, because I've got pretty much the same setup at my studio. So it was a good choice for not floundering around too much in a new room and wondering what's going on. We definitely got used to it though, right? I think for
I was going to say there wasn't that much to get used to because it's just getting used to monitors for me is doing a mix, taking it away and seeing how it sounds, and then you gradually get to learn that way. But what we took away sounded great, so there wasn't much getting used to it.
No, we did some very broad tonal stuff on everything at one point, but that was it, and not much. New tweaks are there.
Was this your first Atmos mix, Kent?
Oh, yeah.
How about you?
I think it was around 1700th or something.
Okay, you have lots of experience.
Why do you think I went with Emre?
A lot by that point. My God. Yeah. So that was...
I actually went when the whole Atmos thing first came up about 2 years ago. And my first thought was, oh, I can learn that. I'll just dig into it. And the first thing that I learned was I've got to have a bigger and better computer system to handle it all. Then I started to get into it further, and I realized that the learning curve at that point, it would have been for a 75-year-old, was a little bit too much. During that period, one of the things I knew that I wanted to do was get some real room sounds to go with everything. So I went into Abbey Road number 2 and fed stems through speakers and picked them up on mics that I had originally arranged with Abbey Road to have set up all the way along the studio. It finished up, we hardly used any of those mics at all. And I'll let Emre tell you what we did use in a minute. But that was the next thing for me. And then I met Emre at an MPG Awards dinner. And after talking with him a bit, I realized how much he knew about Atmos that I didn't and probably would never know. And when finally I was given the go-ahead to really get into it properly, I immediately called up a friend of mine and said, that guy I spoke to at the MPG Awards, who was he? Oh, you mean Emre? I said, yes, put me in touch with him. And that was it. We met up. We seemed to have the same kind of thoughts about Atmos. And it worked amazingly. And Bobby, you know, for me, I like to engineer my own productions. So for me to actually find an engineer that I could work with, not have to tell him what to do the entire time and enjoy the whole process, it hasn't happened in 60 odd years until now. So it was quite a find for me.
It was fun 12 days, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
You did the whole thing in 10, 12 days?
I think maybe 11, was it something?
Because I think I originally booked 10 days, didn't I? And maybe we threw one in because the record company was coming down to hear it and other people were coming down to hear it.
I think it was 10 days, in fact. It was absolutely terrifying because from multi-track, from tape, that's not enough time.
But it was.
And then, it was. And then about two, maybe on day one or two, Ken very gently said, we also have to do new stereo mixes, but it's fine. We'll get on with this. I was like, what? But then I think we discussed on day one or two, we said, right, hang on, you can do fold downs to stereo from Atmos. And I think they're amazing, depending how you mix. But if you go for decent headphone translation and stuff, I found them to be really good. So the stereo fold down is the new stereo mix. It's not a stereo mix, it's an Atmos mix, but it's folded down to stereo. And it, actually, it's folded down from the 5.1 fold down that the loudness measurement is taken from into stereo. And we did tiny tweaks on maybe 6 or 7 of them, I think.
I don't think it was that many. I thought there was only like three or four. We just boosted the vocal like half dB to a dB, and the rest of it was all perfect.
Yeah, because you can live monitor the stereo mix in Atmos on the render just with a click instantly. So we left it in Atmos and made the stereo mix, which was mastered. And that's what they sound good to me.
Now, I should explain one thing. Now, my whole thing, and I think it was something else that Emre wasn't used to in the slightest, but the way I thought about it. Number one, if you're doing a new way of listening, you should work for that new way of listening. I had gone through the 5.1 situation back in 2003, I think it was, with Ziggy, and it was when I was asked to do it, I said to the record company, I can do it one of two ways. There are two ways I can do it. I can do it like the original and just place everything exactly the same, but in just different places, or I can modernize it. And they said, oh, we'd love both, but we can only afford to do one. So do it the same as the original. So that was match it up as close as possible and just put them in different places. That's just boring as shit, quite honestly. So I didn't want to go that way. If I was going to do a new way of listening, immersive audio, I wanted it to be a new experience.
If you're tired of your mixes coming out muddy, thin, or lifeless, I have great news. You can take the quality of your mixes from amateur to pro level using the techniques of the world's top mixers. I'll show you these quick solutions to 15 common mix problems with my Mix Fix playbook. Go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. So your approach to this, then, I'm curious. There's been some mixes that I've heard of classic material that are so adventurous that it kind of loses the glue. And there are others I've heard that are really good, and they tend to be less adventurous. So which approach did you take?
I can only speak for myself. I think it was less adventurous, but Emre has done more and knows more. So would you say it was adventurous or less adventurous?
I think the main thing is when they become somewhat like a Dolby Cinema advert with lots of movement, and that's weird to me almost every time without exception. Unless there's some occasional moments where you go, that felt like it was part of the music moving for some reason, but there's almost none I hear with lots of movement that seemed to make any sense. So we sort of didn't really do that. I tend almost never to do it. Depends what it is. Some things I've done quite a bit of movement on, but that's the intention. You know, it's rare. Then though, these are more immersive mixes rather than gimmicky, I'd say.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I would have said gimmicky.
I think if you didn't notice our Atmos, I wouldn't be sad at all. And if you turn your head to the right and realize you're being surrounded by the music, that's brilliant. But if you sat there and went, this just feels natural, that would be great too. But they are really fully immersive. They are right the way around you, right? But they're not sort of made with that, let's dazzle you with this tech kind of approach at all. Some of the dazzling bits are in the boring stuff, like the fold down works, you know, and it translates well on headphones and it sounds coherent and glued, which is actually down to the tracking. Because normally I would match the mix bus and mastering across all the objects and everything to make sure it's all coherent. And we use one compressor on one channel in the whole record on one tune. It's a testament to the recording, which Ken never lets me get away with when I say this, but it's just absolutely, it's all there. Everything's in the tracking and it sticks together and you can move it around and nothing falls to pieces, you know, with intention, not just randomly, but it's, you know, it's really, the intention is burned into the multitrack.
In doing this, I actually got to experience a real producer-type conversation. And that was, well, this is the lead-in of 5 years, the opening track, where the drums fade in. And I said to Emery, now, I want the drums to come up the hill and over the top of the hill and come down just here. I would just have laughed like crazy if a producer had ever said that to me. But those words actually came out of my mouth in this mix. And I'm not ashamed of them.
But it just goes to show you that you could actually do that.
Oh, I know.
Where, you know, before you couldn't. So, yes, it would have been much more abstract in the past. No.
I think it's really cool when you can have that contrast. There are some bits, for sure, that really leap out, but they're sort of meant to. And they do in the original productions as well. They're real meant to. So.
I'm curious. So you said you only use one compressor. Most people say that they're using far less processing when they do an immersive mix because you don't need it because there's lots of space. So I suppose that was the same then for you guys.
Well, I find, no, I'm using, depending how stems are delivered, because they're mainly done from stems, I'm doing a whole mix bus, but I don't use the bed at all because it doesn't translate well to headphones for me. So I'll do it across objects. And if I have a lot of objects, it'll be a lot of channels of mix bus. So there'll be an unbelievable amount of processing. And that's most of the time the only way it stays coherent when I'm moving it around. This was kind of unusual in that it didn't need anything. I mean, that's really unusual. What I'm doing a lot less of is limiting. And to match really limited masters, I'll do significantly less limiting and significantly less clipping. And it will feel identical, but it'll have loads more headroom and loads more dynamic range. It's great for that. And then you notice it in the fold down significantly. But in this, there's some EQ, right? I think.
Mm.
There is, I mean, for me, none, no compression whatsoever. I mean, one on one channel in one track of the album is basically zero.
Well, Emery, you'll appreciate this. When I work with Ken engineered a project that I was producing. I realized that he approaches EQ different than anybody else I've ever seen. And actually, it's better because he EQs the microphones rather than the instrument.
Yeah.
So, for instance, what brought that really to fore was we had a drum kit all set up, and then during the same song, we needed a second drum sound. So we pulled the drum kit out, put another one in, and it didn't change anything, and it sounded great. And I looked at him, I said, so, really? You're not going to change anything? He says, no, it doesn't need it. And
told me about
it struck
this.
Me, wow, this is an unbelievable way to work.
Yeah, so this is what you told me about, exactly that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Let's talk about ambience. What did you use? You mentioned, Ken, that you recorded ambiences and then failed to use them.
Well, what we failed to use were the mics that I had set up all along, like Neumann U67s, 47s, and C12s. It's Abbey Road. You've got the choice of all of these old mics. You've got to use them, was my thought. It just so happened that someone that was visiting with me brought in a different mic and said, would you mind if we set this up in the middle of the room and give it a try? I said, fine, there's no problem. So we set it up. We never listened to it at all at the time. It wasn't till, and I didn't have the decoder and all of that to do it, until we got to Rack. Once we got to hear this other strange mic that I hadn't requested or anything, that it changed everything. Emery, you tell about the mic, what it was.
It was a Core Octo mic. When you decode it, it was outrageous. We tried it on headphones at first in my studio, I think, because looking, how are we going to do this? What have you got? And there are all these arrays, which did sound really nice, but the Octo mic just sounded like you were there in the room. Absolutely could. And I've got another sort of immersive tool by PSP called an Aural Control or something, I think it's called. And it's a sort of a mixer where you can jiggle around levels. And then the sound particle matrix thing, where I could sort of really dial in how we wanted this mic to work. And we could just wrap the Studio 2 around the dry sounds, and it sounded really natural. And then anything we didn't have the recording for, we could use Altiverb, which really, Altiverb 8 is so good. I could then get a very, very similar, almost identical kind of ambience and fill out the sounds exactly. So you have this kind of ambience, which you don't, it's not like a, not like it sounds like things are reverby or washy. There's just some glue going on in the room, which is quite, is not this huge long Studio 2 sound at all, is it? It's this sort of like, it's kind of tight, but it's just things sit nicely. And when they moved around, we could change where the Octomic was projecting. And as long as we were careful with it, it worked really well. And use some of the canopies mics, the overheads from the other array to fill in the tops if it was needed or not. And yeah, and then lots, the Octomic's massively full range. I mean, it's crazy. It's got a really big low extension actually. So we were filtering that quite a lot. And I think when I was preparing some samples for a talk Ken was giving, I listened to the raw Octomic. I was like, oh my God. It's absolutely enormous. We didn't ever use it in its full range, but we definitely bent things around according to what they were to work. And that was quite a lot of the process, wasn't it? It was bringing up those ambient ones and then filling out others and working out where things might go. And it wasn't just like a template, right, this goes here, that goes there, let's move on. It was every mix was like, what's this one? The only thing that was consistent is where the vocals were, pretty much, I think, which were kind of floating up and slightly forward, which was unusual, but meant that it was really cool how that worked. And it's a great sitting in a new room, because I know where they're meant to be, and then you feel, often you hear in rooms where the center and the elevations aren't necessarily where you would hope them to be sometimes, and it really leaps out with that positioning.
I think what goes along with this, one comment that I've had was from Woody Womansey, who was Bowie's drummer in Spiders from Mars. And he said when he listened to some of it, I don't think he's heard the whole thing, but what he did hear, he said, it made me think I was in the band. And he meant that because it felt as if he was there with them inside the whole thing, which is, to me, what we were aiming for.
That's awesome. Okay, so was this originally on 16 track?
Correct.
Did you use any separation tools or anything to maybe isolate some of the tracks?
Not on this one. No, everything is as you would wish it to be. The only thing that, again, when I was preparing these excerpts, I did notice the spell on the orchestra, which I didn't in the room when we were mixing it at all. Because this isn't really, I don't think probably either of us mix really with anything much in solo particularly. I don't know if I soloed the orchestra really particularly or intentionally, but that was the only thing that kind of had some spill on.
What Emre's referring to is that when we did that, when we recorded Ziggy back in 72, the session musicians were, some of them were a little fussy. The brass players were great. They would wear headphones when they got back from the pub. Then the string players, oh no, this is pop music. This is terrible. And they refused to wear headphones. So we had to feed it to them through speakers. And obviously, if it's loud enough for them to hear through speakers, it's loud enough for the microphones to pick them up. So there is spill coming from speakers of the rhythm track and sometimes the vocal. And it's picked up. I remember I mentioned the 5.1 that I did earlier. I remember the first time I pulled up just the strings to listen to them, and suddenly there's all of this other stuff coming through. And I thought, hang on, I thought I just pulled up the strings. And then it suddenly clicked. That's coming through the speakers, of course. I'd completely forgotten that because it had been so many years of using headphones. I'd forgotten what it used to be like.
In regard to splitting things up more than is in the tracking, I didn't ever want to do that myself at all. It was like, balances are perfect, cohesion's perfect. I wouldn't change a thing. So I didn't ever feel like I'd want to separate anything more. I can't think of particularly anything we would have split anywhere. No, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything.
I don't think you mastered this, did you? In traditional sense.
Mastering. I always master the, if it's a multi-track, I'll mix it and master in stereo before I start mixing. But because that's to match the stereo that I'm matching the Atmos to, this wasn't the case, because this was making the stereo after we finished the Atmos. So it was luxury Atmos mixing for me, because I didn't do any of that mastering process, and we could just mix in effectively in Atmos, have it feel coherent, fold it down to stereo. And then we had John Weber from Air just came in, was fantastic, listened to everything I had to say and my concerns about anyone doing any mastering post it, and then did an absolutely brilliant job of every part of it, I thought. And so that was the first time I think I've had anything mastered at all in Atmos. And I said how I would want to do it, and that's the way he did it. And that was great. And so that was a very, very pleasant experience, I think, from what could have been quite worrying, I'd say, because there's so many things that can go wrong that people won't even notice. And unless they've mixed it themselves, like, it's really easy to lose metadata. It's really easy to have there's so many things that could be a problem. But he was.
And I think the other thing with that was his coming down to the studio and hearing it the way we heard it.
Yeah, it was great.
And so he knew what we were after, what our intent was. And just to explain one thing about this, that the whole thing of taking the stereo from the Atmos. One of the things that transpired was the whole thing of Apple needing the stereo to match up with the immersive audio. And that's fine if you're working totally digitally, because the stereo and the multi-track, if you like, will always run at the same speed, run together. The problem is when you start to work with analog, with tape, the machines never run at the same speed twice. So the only way you can get the stereo to match up with the multi-track would be using Elastic Audio or something to match up the tempos completely all the way through, bar by bar, note by note.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
You lose quality doing that. So I said, we have to do both a new stereo mix as well as the immersive audio. And one of the things that made this so pleasant for me personally, Mr. Bowie said that to the powers that be, that the only people that can work on his product are the original people, which means I get to work on the albums that I did with him. Tony Visconti gets to work on the albums that he did with him. Harry Maslen gets to work on with what he did. And that we know the original intention. Unlike what happens with so many artists is they'll give it out to whoever the engineer du jour is. And it is, they don't know what the original intention was. So it's not necessarily as it should be. Having his blessing, even from the beyond, gave me the if you like, the power to be able to say, I've got to do both. And if they wanted to do it, they had to go along with what I said, which was great. I felt that the stereo should match up to the Atmos as opposed to the Atmos matching up to the stereo. And that's why we did it the way we did it.
That sounds like a better way to work.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so here's the big question then, listening on headphones, and especially the translation between Dolby and Apple. How did you manage that?
I can tell you one thing very briefly before I pass it over to Emre. And that is that at one point, Emre said to me, put the headphones on, listen to it on them. Put the headphones on, said, okay, play it. Within 5 seconds, I'd taken the headphones off and looked around because I thought he had it coming through the speakers as well. And it wasn't. It was purely through the headphones. So what we were doing, what Emre was doing, worked. Now over to you, Emre, as to that part of it, to the question.
When I'm doing my more ordinary Atmos work, most of my time is spent making the binaural mix absolutely identical to the stereo mix in terms of balance and level, which is tricky but can be done. And almost indistinguishable, sometimes preferred, often over, because it's slightly more dynamic and it's less fatiguing. It can be punchier and sometimes feel a little bit more, but identical to the stereo mix. So that's really a lot of the work. There's no control over Apple Spatial at all, and it changes constantly. And you have no control over, there's no, the DDNJSC codec doesn't read the metadata, so it just is, everything's spatialized the same, which is somewhere between near and mid kind of feeling, with variable levels for your center speaker if you're using that, which I don't tend to use much at all because of exactly this issue. So there's all kinds of, and certainly height can be a massive issue in Apple Spatial, things getting boosting quite significantly depending on frequency and how much they egress into the scene. You can get like 5 dB difference between Apple Spatial and binaural without changing anything your end. You know, it's for me not ideal, but the head tracking is incredible, and it's clearly they want to use it because of VR. You know, the Vision Pro is laughable to some people now, but it's the alpha effectively of what their incredible products they'll be making, which will be unbelievably amazing and accessible in many years. That's what their focus is. It's not on headphones. Their focus is on, you know, new technology, and that's, I get it. But unfortunately for music, I don't find it acceptable to change my mix intention, sorry, at all. You know, especially when I put it out. So I'd rather it read the metadata or turn the front wall off. Just have the front wall non-spatialized at all as an option. So at least it would sound tonally the same, because at the moment tonally it is different, and that's really troublesome. So I've had a very particular Grammy winning dance artist in LA who said, well, the binaural mix is great. It sounds incredible. They often don't. This is, it just sounds like my mix. I was like, great. But we have to fix the Apple Spatial now. And I was like, I can't do it, anything. And he just didn't really believe me. But then he did, you know, eventually. So I just ended up changing the master mix and the binaural mix, making it less immersive, less what the intention was, to make the damage in the spatial less. So that's a shame. In this, we didn't even listen to the Apple Spatial, because actually was fairly confident because of how we were laying things out that it would be as good as it could be. It wouldn't be like a bad sound. And we've heard it in spatial, and it sounds like a spatial version of what we did. So that's cool. But yeah, it's a problem. It's a tricky thing. It's like not really, there's nothing I can do. I don't have separate binaural data for the Apple Spatial version. I can't choose how far things are in the binaural room, and I can't do anything about it, which is, as a mix engineer, it's frustrating. Definitely.
You know, I had something happen. Speaking about the head tracking, something happened to me. I was in the dentist's office and I had my Apple AirPod Maxes on, and I was listening to talk radio. Yeah. And I turned my head and it was now over here. I turned it again, it was over here. And it was the most disconcerting thing, especially for talk radio. It's like, oh, wait, where are you?
Yeah. It's really odd, isn't it? It's like a virtual living room, you know, but which I get, you know, and it's an interesting thing. I'd love it to be an option. I'd love there to be a music mode.
Last question for both you guys. So since this was your first Atmos project, what did you learn from it? And what would you tell people to expect?
Are you talking about the listening public, or are you talking about people working in it?
People working in it.
I would say that if you want Atmos to actually work and to take off and have the public eventually get to like it, pay for it, use it, start to think about it differently. Don't think about it as the stereo just in different places. It is a new way of listening, and I think you have to treat it that way completely. Otherwise, it's pointless. Let's just stick with the stereo. Why? It doesn't mean much. The whole thing with movies, you've got things going on. They attempt to make it feel as if you're there, kind of thing, with the helicopter flying above you and all of that kind of thing. A stereo mix put in different places doesn't make you feel that way. I think it needs to be made so that you actually feel that you're listening to something new and different, or you're in a live situation, like Woody playing it. I'm playing, kind of thing. That would be my whole thing.
Henry, how about you? What would you recommend to somebody who's just starting?
You have to work out what you're, who you're working for. Are you working for a label, Dolby, or the artist, or are they all mutually exclusive? It's really complicated. So I think a lot of the stuff that I would prefer not to listen to in Atmos is two things. One slightly technical and then one more theoretical. But the technical thing is you're being sent stems often to work from. And this is slightly off piece with the question, but it's really important because it does kind of answer it. And most pop modern mixing is the limiter comes on at some point, or clipping comes on very early on in the mix, and the mix bus gets top-down mixing, gets pretty heavy quite quickly. And the stems are not quite... Well, I don't know, from what I can tell, people take all that off and then make stems and then send them to the label. And that's what they send Atmos mixes. So this isn't a mix that has ever been heard or is finished, because the mix was mixed into quite a brutal mix bus and that's gone. So you're getting stems, which are not a mix. And then people are putting those stems in Atmos, further removing any kind of cohesion. And that's what I'm hearing on a vast number of Atmos mixes now. It's like, this has never been a mix that, you're pressing play on ever. And so making mix stems from those top-down sessions is actually technically difficult and people don't do it. And depending how people hit them, it can be just fine running it through it and sending. So it depends what you get from who. So it's a bit of a broad stroke, but I hear a lot of stuff that is not a mix. I can hear this was never a mix. This is the unprocessed mix stems and no one's made them a mix afterwards and then mix them in Atmos. So I'd think, what are you working from? Is this, when I press play, is this a mix before I start? And if it isn't, then I would just stop and make it and mix it, you know, finish it. So you haven't got a chance of doing that when it's immersive. It's not going to work. Like, you press play on the multitrack from Ken and it's done, you know, bar 5% if you want to do stuff, but you know, it's done. This is, you know, you're 95% away on a lot of things I hear. You need to, it's not a mix. So that's one thing I think, what are you mixing from? If you're mixing from multitrack, then that's a different thing. And how are you mixing? I did a lot of stuff for Brian Eno, and I did my first thing I did was come in, and what I would do for a major label, which is make this respectful, immersive, fully immersive, quite, but when it folded down, it was all very much the mix, the stereo mix, exactly the same, front facing. And he basically came in and said, this is wonderful. He's done an incredible job. We're just going to change absolutely everything. So, which is great. He gave me the opportunity to do something different. So that was good. And that was absolutely brilliant. We did, it was just nothing to do with the stereo, which is great, because it was a new, I don't want the stereo. I've got the stereo mix. I don't want to do that again. So we did something cool and creative across 10 albums. And I did one day with him and then did 10 albums. And he came in at the end and made two changes on 10 albums. You know, it was very little. Just like, yeah, do something. I don't want it to be the same. You know, so that was great. But for a pop act where I'm getting 7 stems or something, it's like, this is a different job here. I could do something like move one thing here, move one thing there, but it's a much more involved process in some ways, because I've got less to work with, but I have to make this feel immersive for some kind of point, rather than just pan this over here and pan the invoice over there. You know, it's not that. It's, why am I doing this? So that's digging a bit deeper and going, what could I do here that would actually be worthwhile? So that's job two, you know. So I think it's working out what job you're doing is what I would say. What have I got to work with? Why am I doing this? And don't just knock something out and get paid, because that's, you can do that because it's the Wild West at the moment, easily. And most, you know, you could do it on headphones, knock something out, someone's going to listen to it on headphones. But your master file, which is going to become more and more relevant, especially if a big DSP starts doing Atmos, which I strongly assume they will, then it becomes even more of a big deal to have a good master mix. I'm possibly, I don't know, because it's such a big economic thing, thinking that a lot of artists might actually start to hear the master mixes they've approved or someone's approved and go, what the hell is this? And that might be interesting to see what happens down the line when it becomes more relevant as a format, because immersive audio is not going away. And I think Atmos is one. So we'll see what happens. Mixes that, you know, of the type Ken's talking about cannot lose. It's what it is. You know, you've made the mix and you've done something new, and that's mixed. So you've inherently mixed. But when you're trying to match something and haven't really, or there's no real intention behind it, I think you might have a problem down the line. So I think that's either nail that, which is really hard. It's really tricky. There's so many pitfalls and so much you have to know. So there's an economic barrier to that anyway. It's like, you need to be at a level of experience, which it's not paying for really. So that's a problem. Or spend all your time doing it or do something. I mean, my situation is very unusual and lucky that I got into it and it's worked out, but it's a tricky thing to navigate at the moment. So I think if you can do something new and original and brilliant, that's the best way forward. Definitely.
Well, maybe I'll try that next time.
Yeah. like you know, it's a new thing. It's just, you know, just like when we first talked about it, it was like, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
And if the artist isn't there and the producer isn't involved and the mixer isn't involved, then that's harder because that's a tricky thing. But that's most of it, I think, is like that. I think, I don't know, that's a ramble, but I think, you know, understand what the job is, maybe.
Oh, I get it. Get it. I think it's a good place to stop, actually. Emery, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for your input here. And Ken, we'll be talking again soon.
Thanks, all Bobby. Right. It was good seeing you again.
Yes, likewise, Ken.
And cheers, Emery. Thank you. Oh, I'll be in touch with you very soon.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ken. Okay. Bye. Love you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.